Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really honored and pleased to welcome into our studios today two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, both from the Political Science Department, Dr. Jerry Mast and Dr. Jeff Roberg, who have joined us any number of times to offer their analysis of various political events and trends and issues. And of course, what brings them to WGTD's studios this morning is to offer some analysis of the Republican National Convention, which of course finished up last night with the acceptance speech of Donald Trump. And so we're going to talk about what was said last night by Mr. Trump, what was said by other figures on that stage in Cleveland over the course of these last 3 days, overall, what the convention accomplished or failed to accomplish, and what might be ahead for Mr. Trump in this bid to become our next president. And next Friday, President Roberg, Professor Roberg, gave you a little promotion there. Yes, Professor Roberg. Yeah,
Professor.
Professor Roberg will be back to offer his analysis of the Democratic convention, which will have finished by that point in time. Unfortunately, Professor Mast is going to be in some exotic locale on vacation, I think. So, but we'll miss you, but look forward to our conversation nevertheless. And welcome to both of you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Greg.
Good to have you here. It's tempting to talk first about Mr. Trump's speech last night, because that is what is on so many minds this morning. But I think it makes more sense for us to talk about the overall convention first, and let's kind of culminate in what was said last night and then talk about what is stretching ahead. So going into this convention, what needed to happen? And were the organizers, party officials, and Mr. Trump and his insiders even on the same page when it came to what this convention needed to accomplish?
Well, conventionally, conventions are an important point in which campaigns pivot, right, from the primary election to the general. And that involves some kind of challenges, right? One that challenge is to, on the one hand, unite the party, right, smooth over differences that emerged over the course of a contentious primary season. To unite the party, but then to reach outward to the general population, to see if you can't touch base with those people who haven't been paying really close attention to the primary season, the people in the middle, perhaps, and try to grow your base of support, and to put a face on the candidate, to humanize him or her, and kick off the general election. So that conventionally, that's what conventions are supposed to do. I would argue that that was going to always be a real challenge for the Trump campaign for a number of reasons. And I would say that if we look historically, conventions have very consistently provided their candidate a bump, but that bump has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller on average over the last couple of decades. And I would say that given the difficulties that the Trump campaign faces in the general election, they really could have used a really successful convention to get the campaign off on the right foot to tackle some of those difficult challenges. And I would have to say that this convention was not what they needed. It was fascinating from the perspective of people who follow politics. But while it wasn't a train wreck, it was, there were a number of red flags.
Professor Roberg, you would you assess it similarly?
I would start with where Jerry was, and then I'd add to it a little bit in terms of, so conventions are trying to tell you who the candidate or candidates are, and it gives the candidates a chance and all the folks that they put on stage as well a chance to retell a bio or perhaps to reinvent a bio. Both of the presidential candidates this time around have to reinvent themselves a little bit because there is a historical past, if you will, to each of them that, you know, parts they, that's not the, the side that they necessarily want to show. And that the general populace feels they already know the candidates, so they want to get a particular message out in terms of what they stand for and what they believe and how they will carry out whatever the process is that they are trying to do. Jerry's certainly right in terms of we're talking about a jump off to the general election. One hopes normally that a convention will give you a main message coming out of it. It doesn't have to be a single message, but it should at least be
clear one.
Is a as far as a successful convention and what that is certainly includes those things that, that Jerry spoke about and what I just added. Did they have it? Well, perhaps, right? If we go under the mantra of all news is good news, right, as long as they spell your name correctly, then life is good.
Certainly, so as long as people are paying attention, it's
right.
good.
I mean, certainly the Trump folks stepped on their message a lot, as well as the folks that they had put on the stage. There wasn't one unified message. And, of course, each evening had some version of drama to it. We got to witness, of course, a young Trump campaign not understanding how to do away with bad news quickly on the first night. But then going beyond that, too, each night had its own set of problems, whether the second night had to do with some voting issues in the RNC, third night, of course, Ted Cruz. So in that regard, you know, it was interesting, and I had commented to Jerry about this earlier, that you know, if you hadn't watched the first three nights, and then the first thing you tuned into was Ivanka last night, suddenly you had a different kind of message out there that was divorced in large part from not only the first three nights, but also the first couple hours of the convention last night.
One of the things that was striking to me is that there had been publicized sort of a framework or format by which this convention supposedly was going to unfold, in which each day or each night was going to be focused on a different theme. Let's make America strong again or safe again. Let's make America work again. I forget what all of them were. But it seems as though that format was discarded right from the start, which in and of itself is kind of interesting, but also makes you wonder exactly who was running this convention. I mean, who, behind the scenes, who was making the decisions about who was going to speak and what they were going to say and what was going to happen next? Is it possible for us to even know the answer to that question about exactly who was in charge of this convention? I mean, obviously, Mr. Trump was at the heart and soul of it, but in terms of the nuts and bolts of what happened, who's responsible for that?
Generally speaking, it's going to be the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee cooperating with and in collaboration with the campaign of the nominee. They work that out together. I thought that among the red flags that I noted over the course of the week was a real lack of coherence in terms of messaging. And your point about the inability of the convention to stick to some kind of thematic format is indicative of that. Earlier this morning on your station, you had a little piece put together by Sean Johnson, the Madison bureau chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and in that piece, he spoke with a couple of people, one of whom was the conservative radio host Charlie Sykes, up in Milwaukee, and Mr. Sykes said that rather despondently that the convention represented to him the kind of the defeat of the Republican Party, the takeover of the Republican Party by Trumpism. And I think in some sense that's correct. And the question I think that we're all going to be thinking about in the coming weeks is, what is Trumpism? What does it mean? What is the message that the Trump campaign, that Trump himself, that the convention is trying to communicate to us? And it's not clear to me that there is some kind of positive vision for the country residing within Trumpism. There's a whole lot of fear. Many commentators have said that this convention has been about drumming up fear, making people afraid, making people hate Hillary Clinton. Convention's very consistent on that. We should be afraid. We should hate Hillary Clinton. But what it hasn't done is provide us with a clear understanding of where this country ought to head and how we're going to get there. So this lack of coherence on the themes of today is going to be about America first, America, make America safe again, make America America again, right? I mean, there's this theme that they rolled out there that didn't get fulfilled because, in some sense, I don't see the clear positive message.
I agree with everything that Jerry said there. One of the speakers a couple nights ago talked about Trump as a ringmaster, and the themes were certainly a good idea in terms of but they were jettisoned early and often. With very few actually addressing the theme for the particular night. In conventions as a general, right, they try and give you a, why should you vote for this person and why am I better than the other person? Jerry's absolutely correct that we saw a lot of, you should vote for me because of anxiety, because of fear of the other side. We saw that the chant, of course, of for anti-Hillary in terms of lock her up, among other chants that were out there as such. But in terms of electoral politics for a general election, that's great red meat for your base, but it does nothing or little, I'll phrase it that way, right, to really expand your base.
David Brooks called it the criminalization of political difference this morning.
Yeah. So, you're trying to, raise, in this case, Hillary Clinton's negatives, but you're not raising the positives of Donald Trump. Both of these candidates come into this election with very high negatives and frankly, a lot of flaws. I don't know for Republicans if it's possible to, quote unquote, hate Hillary Clinton more, right? So why not spend the time on, this is what we're going to do for the country, and this is, by the way, is how we're going to deliver these things.
It's hard, though, for them to put together that positive message given the positions that Trump has taken. He's gone after some sacred cows on the Republican Party, right? So in terms of economic policy, we've seen the Republican Party been pretty consistently in favor of a number of things. One, free trade, right? That'll start there. I'm sure we can come back to it and elaborate on this point at some length. Trump has definitely gone after free trade. The party, starting with our own congressman, Mr. Ryan, has made entitlement reform a significant plank, right? The attempt to at least partially privatize Social Security and to privatize Medicare. And Trump has steered clear of that. Absolutely. He said he wants to preserve them in their current form. When it comes to foreign policy, right, the Republican Party has been a party that has engaged in the world, a party that is very much committed to this notion of American exceptionalism. We are the shining city on the hill that serves as an example, right, to the world. And this kind of paragon of democratic principle and economic freedom that we are committed to promoting around the world. And in this week's interview with the New York Times, Mr. Trump has essentially said, who are we, right, to tell a turkey to commit to democratic principles? Now, that's the kind of criticism that you often hear from the academic left, that the United States has fallen far short of its principles and isn't doesn't have any business, you know, shaking a finger around the world. You hear it from the Soviet – or not the Soviet Union, from Russia and from Putin, right? Well, once upon a time you heard it from the Soviet Union. But you don't typically hear it from Republican candidates, right? So Mr. Trump has gone after kind of conventional Republican positions in a very, very fascinating, surprising way. So it's hardly surprising to me that we don't see a kind of a coherent, positive message coming out of Cleveland's convention this week, because what are they going to agree to? Right. My big problem with Trump's speech last night was its complete lack of explanation for anything. Right. It's this long litany of zigzagging declarative statements about, you know, we're going to become safe. Right. America's going to be safe. The law and order will happen on January 20th when I'm sworn in. You know, good jobs will start showing up. ISIS will get crushed. We're going to win, right? That's what he just says. We're going to win. We're going to win. But he doesn't explain himself. He doesn't provide us with any detail. And it seems, on the one hand, as frustrating as a lack of explanation or detail is, it also makes sense because he himself has deviated in significant ways from the kind of the conservative program that the Republican Party has been crafting. Mm-hmm.
And we see this there's a big difference between campaigning and governing. And every incoming administration has learned this lesson. Some learned it harder than others.
or more slowly.
President Carter was not a good governor as such. He didn't understand, and I don't mean governor of Georgia, but governor of the United States in terms of understanding how the executive branch worked and what was necessary to do. Governing is hard work, and I think we saw that reflected in the messages of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell as well as Speaker Ryan in terms of they didn't deal with the policies or generalities, if you will, of Donald Trump. What they both basically said was Trump is good because he will sign Republican congressional legislation.
Because he's right? Not Hillary Clinton.
That's right. Let's keep the Senate in Republican hands. In the case of Paul Ryan, his focus was on the party. It was not on Trump. He said, elect a governing, a conservative governing majority. But neither McConnell or Ryan were in prime time, right? Mm. So while if you were on Fox or MSNBC or PBS, you might have seen their speeches, although McConnell's wasn't shown completely, certainly not by Fox, then, you know, you wouldn't have heard that message at all. So we do have an internal or general struggle, if you will, between whatever Trumpism is and the Republican Party as it was.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you could extend that or maybe modify it a little bit in the sense that I think it would it's fair to ask how coherent and positive a vision did the Republican Party have before Trump showed up on the scene? The Republican Congress over the last number of years has been really clear about what it's against, right? It's against Obamacare. It's against some kind of feckless aimlessness of Obama's foreign policy. But it doesn't really substitute something positive in its place. I was struck at the rather strong language used by a Republican in yesterday's New York Times. And I'm going to just quote what this gentleman had to say. This is Bruce Bartlett, an economist, Republican economist, who's an advisor to Ron Paul, the Texas representative, back in the 1970s. And after he left Ron Paul's employment, he went to work for Jack Kemp. Some of our listeners will remember Mr. Kemp, Republican congressman from New York, pretty sharp fellow, policy oriented, very much a wonk, what we would call a wonkish kind of congressman, who was the Republican Party's nominee for vice president in 1996 with Robert Dole. Bartlett also went to work. He became the director of the Joint Economic Committee for Congress. He became a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He was a senior analyst for the Office of Policy Development in the White House under George Herbert Walker Bush. So this is a man with credentials, very scholarly and very, very long history of working for the Republican Party. And this is what he had to say about the Republican Party yesterday. And I quote, "The Republican Party today is basically a coalition of grievances, united by one thing, hatred. Hatred of immigrants, hatred of minorities, hatred of intellectuals, hatred of gays, feminists, and many other groups, too numerous to mention. What binds them together is hatred of Democrats because they are welcoming to every group that Republicans reject. A new Republican coalition must be assembled, purged of the haters and know-nothings. But I expect that process to take decades."
Wow.
This is not some liberal, right? This is this is a conservative economist from the Republican Party. Now, we should note he dropped his membership to the Republican Party in 2009, 2010 or so, and became an independent. But I think it's really indicative of some real problems on the Republican Party side. This lack of coherent positive message, right? It's all about tax cuts for particularly the higher income brackets, deregulation, and letting the market kind of sort things out. There's no real clear sense of what Republicans want the government to do. Except less, right? And so, along comes Trump and he doesn't have a very consistent or clear or for sure detailed message of what to do, but in some sense he inherited, right, a political direction in which there isn't a clear positive message.
That's a really interesting observation because that helps make sense of Mr. Trump's success, because in a sense what it's sometimes painted as someone who came along and hijacked the Republican Party. And what you're suggesting is he sort of preyed upon a vulnerability that was already there.
A real vulnerability in the foundation of the Republican House, that the foundation was rotting to begin with in many respects because it had emphasized all the things that the Democrats do wrong. And they do plenty of things wrong. They emphasize problems that the country has. And the country has problems. But what they haven't emphasized, aside from some kind of hopeful expectation that the marketplace will solve it. They haven't provided us with solutions.
Interesting. One of the comments about a coalition of what was it?
Grievances.
A coalition of grievances and one party perhaps being much more inclusive and welcoming than the other brings to mind maybe what you've seen on social media, the two photographs juxtaposed together of all of the Republican interns on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And then
all of the
Democratic interns on Capitol
Stark
Hill.
Stark differences.
Right. I mean, and the one is a sea of white faces. I don't remember seeing a single face that was not Caucasian. Maybe there was a speckle of one or two, but and then this picture of Democratic interns, which was every color of the rainbow. I mean,
in the wake of the 2012 election,
the autopsy,
right? Reince Priebus and a number of other party insiders, sat down and said, "Well, what's going on? Why did we lose? What do we got to do?" Performed, the autopsy report of the Republican Party, and they identified exactly what you're describing in that Facebook meme, the internet meme of the interns, right? Because that is a signpost of the future, and it's not a very positive message for the Republican Party. And what Mr. Priebus and others concluded was the party has to be more inclusive. It has to not be about grievances. It has to find ways to reach out and diversify the party. And I mean, they understood that. They still understand it. And yet, you have to feel for Mr. Priebus having to stand at the helm of the party at this point, given that his party has nominated a man who's gone out of his way to antagonize people, to antagonize these groups that Mr. Priebus has rightly noted have to be reached and persuaded to give them a chance.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg from the Political Science Department at Carthage College, analyzing the Republican convention that finished up last night with the acceptance speech of Donald Trump as the Republican presidential nominee. One thing I want to make sure we take a moment to talk about, we have a couple of things, and then we'll get to last night's speech. There is the matter of the concerted effort early on to somehow alter the rules of the convention, which would have allowed delegates, in a sense, to vote their conscience, to not necessarily cast votes as would be expected. It was a spirited attempt. Did it ever have a chance?
Not really.
No.
In part because of what Jerry was talking about with Reince Priebus and the RNC as a whole. What the RNC has tried to do during this whole process is say we're really not dysfunctional and that we have a good sense of what's going on. These are the rules that were set up a couple of years ago. These are the rules we're going to go by. And in terms of fair play, this is the way it's going to work. We saw that also, by the way, on the second night of the convention, where some votes were not reported the same way that they came in, I'll phrase it that way, particularly having to do with Alaska and Utah, where suddenly Alaska and Utah found their votes all for Trump, or nearly all for Trump, as opposed to what those states had actually voted in terms of their delegates. But because of the way the RNC worked the rules,
Cruz didn't qualify for
right.
the votes. Yeah.
Exactly so.
In addition to all that, I mean, I agree with that. There's just the weight of democracy. The convention isn't going to turn its back on the candidate who got far and away the most votes. The presidential nomination process has been moving in a more democratic direction over time. If you go back to the 1960s, since then, right, the Democrats first reformed their nominating process. The Republicans, in very quick order, followed suit to make delegates bound by the votes of the voters, right, to make the process more reflective of what it is that the voters want. And the Republican primary voters spoke, and they wanted Trump. And I don't think, given the kind of the larger in political environment in which we have come to accept voters should be the ones deciding who gets the nomination, that a convention could have gotten away with.
Now there is an exception in the sense of your larger point is certainly, I agree completely. But when we talk about the platform, right, there's a case where when folks were working on the Republican platform, that was not necessarily reflected by those folks who voted for Trump. There you had a different cadre of folks who were in those meetings that were then able to reflect what they wanted. And in some ways, as your listeners surely know, the platform this year is much more conservative than, say, 2012. The party had been making some general sweeping changes, those regressed this last time.
Yeah. Did Donald Trump mention abortion in his speech last night?
No.
Yeah, it didn't even come up.
And that's central to the party platform.
Very much so. Mm-hmm.
Gay marriage.
Did he mention homosexuality for the LGBTQ community? He did, but only in a kind of a positive way, right? That
right.
we're going to I'm stepping forward. We're going to protect them. They are deserving of our protection. Mr. Trump is a very I would say maybe uninterested, inconsistent, not that credible espouser of social conservatism. I think Jeff is right that the platform represents in some sense pushback against Trumpism by movement conservatives.
What really is the meaning of the platform? I mean, what is its significance, if any?
Well, ideally, a platform, just like a party, offers a roadmap to voters. And that is that no matter who the candidate is, right, you can say these are the things we stand for. In the same way that, you know, if you get on a plane, you don't care what the pilot's name is, right? You expect whoever the pilot is to do a good job and get you to where you want to go.
He's wearing that thing on his lapel.
He went to pilot school.
You can get our plane from point A to point B, and we all arrive safely and happily. In the same way, the platform, as well as the party in general, it's a roadmap to voters. And so the old rules, and you know, maybe we'll talk about this today, maybe we'll talk about another time, is, you know, I would argue that the old rules still apply. Trump is the exception as opposed to the rule, and that is that I can put a D or an R on anyone's name and run them here in the first congressional district, and I can guarantee them 30 to 35% of the vote without them ever saying anything.
Mm.
Anything. And the point is that by the virtue of having that D or R, it's a roadmap to saying, okay, we believe that these are your beliefs. If it's an R there, this is what we expect of you. The platform in many ways is supposed to augment that. Obviously, there are changes year to year. This year, I would say more changes than in recent previous years to the Republican platform. But nonetheless, that's what that's supposed to do.
It's symbolic. It's not binding. It's meant to salve over hurt feelings for certain groups within the party who didn't get their way.
It's not a contract. I mean, right. It doesn't, right? When Congress, when Republicans get to D.C., it's not, oh, well, this is what the platform says is what we're going to do. That's not what that is.
Right. To win the White House requires a very large, heterogeneous coalition of interests. And not all of those interests are going to win out. Some of them are going to be angry or upset. And the platform is in some sense a way to try to reach out and bind that group and create some kind of coherent message.
Mm-hmm. What about the choice of Mr. Pence to be vice president? Is that a choice that makes sense to you? Do you think it makes sense for the Republican Party?
Yeah, I do. I think it was, in some sense, a pretty good choice on his part because of what he kind of balances out the ticket in a personal kind of way, right? Trump is this unusual, unorthodox person who, you know, comes from outside of politics. He's unpredictable. He's not conventional in a Republican sense, and Pence offers the opposite of all that. He is a conventional politician. He's a conventional conservative. he's predictable in that regard. Trump is flashy. Trump is New York City. He's on his third wife now. He's in a way a libertine, right? And Pence is a stolid kind of family man. He's the kind of guy, you know, you could easily see being your neighbor, right? So he's reassuring in a kind of a cultural or social sense.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. So Pence offers something that Trump does not, and that is in the sense of consideration. And what I mean by that is we have some examples of so the question is Jerry raised before of having to do with NATO, and you know Trump has basically said, well, maybe we'll come to the defense of our allies. We'll see if they've done their responsibilities or not, and then we'll figure it out there. And Pence has kind of said, walked that back a little bit and said, yeah, well, what he really meant to say was this. And of course, he also tried to made a nice tie back to JFK and Martin Luther King as well, in terms of starting on the Democratic side of the aisle, if it were, and then changing under the Reagan time as well.
Yeah, whereas Trump is abrasive, Pence is kindlier, right? If warmer.
And this has nothing to do with the policies as such. This is the man, right?
It does also relate to the policies in the way you mentioned, especially with respect to the foreign policy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think it was Judy Woodruff who interviewed him yesterday,
yes.
Right, on from PBS. And she was going through the things about NATO and so forth. And Pence did have very thoughtful responses to them, mitigating in some sense the impetuousness of the responses he was trying to rationalize or defend.
Hmm. It's really interesting to picture the two of them in campaign appearances together.
No, they won't be. I mean, this is probably the last time we'll see them together for quite some time. I mean, occasionally, if they're together more than say 10 times by the end of the or by the beginning of November, I'd be surprised.
We'll see. I mean, normally, yeah. Trump's an interesting fellow, though. But yeah, they probably won't.
Right. Real quick, the matter of Mrs. Trump's speech and that portion in which nearly word for word. Something was lifted from a speech of the First Lady, Mrs. Obama. I don't think that point can be argued in terms of, you know, that in fact was plagiarism. That wasn't an accident. But we should probably talk a moment, because you touched on it briefly earlier, about the way in which this matter, this embarrassment was handled. And I think most people would say it was not handled very well.
And I would argue it's a self-inflicted wound.
Yeah. Indicative and, of a not a well-oiled machine.
No, fair. So mistakes happen in campaigns. We'll take that as a given. And speechwriters do occasionally make mistakes. The problem that the Trump campaign had was not owning it immediately. They let it be over a 2-day news story, by which everything else was then judged for the next day and a half.
Yes, they absolutely bungled the response. But even the build up to the mistake itself is reflective of a larger problem with the campaign. Mr. Trump casts himself as a non-politician. He rejects conventional political wisdom. He is disdainful of people who are professionals within the field of politics, and he's crafted this campaign, right, around this sense that he can do it his way. He doesn't need to follow kind of conventional wisdom because he's Trump. And so when you have the campaign operatives who, you know, he did hire, bring in a couple of speechwriters for George W. Bush to help put together a speech for Melania Trump, Ms. Trump didn't like it. She had abandoned it, and apparently, I mean, all of this is on some level hearsay. Brought in somebody to help her put together something else, without vetting it, right? Mm-hmm. So when this happened in real time, you had professional speechwriters on both sides of the aisle just appalled at this. Like, this can't happen. This cannot be allowed to happen.
It's just such an amateurish error.
Exactly. So, you know, can somebody win the White House running an orthodox kind of campaign that eschews political wisdom, that eschews conventional wisdom? Well, we'll find out, because that's kind of what they're doing.
Let's talk about last night's speech. One of the things that surprised me a little bit was its dark tone. I mean, were you surprised by its dark tone?
Not after the first 3 days.
Right. I mean, it fit with the first 3 days.
Oh, of the convention.
Yes.
Right, right.
I guess there's 2 to 3 different parts of the way the speech was organized. Certainly we have a dark tone out front in terms of, you know, we're in trouble. There's and the reason we're in trouble is because of the Obama administration, and particularly Hillary's to blame for a lot
practically
of these
everything
things. Even though she wasn't around as such, the Iran and Cuba are good examples of that she was blamed for multiple times, and it's like wrong person, but okay. So we certainly have that aspect, and then we switch to this kind of laundry list of you know, these are the things that we're going to do and how we're going to win. With, again, as Jerry mentioned earlier, very little detail on how those things are actually going to be carried out, paid for, et cetera. And then we get to kind of the third part, which is, you know, I'm for you, right? I'm going to be your voice, and this is the way that you know, you will win in this. And so we have kind of 3 aspects of this speech, hitting different parts, if you will. It wouldn't have been the speech that I wrote, but certainly didn't give an uplifting message that kind of said, these are the things, not only the things we're going to do, but this is why we're going to be good for the country and help you, as opposed to
go back to the speeches that Ronald Reagan is famous for giving. There's an element of positivism there.
Yes,
clearly,
right.
Clearly, Reagan was critical of the liberal direction of the culture, the liberal direction of government, and so forth. So he had plenty of criticism to level in his rhetoric, but it was always within some larger framework of positive celebration of America, who we are, and there wasn't much in the way of celebration of America on the part of Mr. Trump. The celebration of Trump as the savior,
and there was the celebration of America, if you want to take it as that, you know, Americanism, not globalism, right, will be our credo, was one of his lines last night. And so, you know, I will support America and all these
America first,
right,
right.
And right. Such. But at the same time, you know, he talked about, you know, we're going to win. We're going to get America's going to get the respect back that we deserve, right? Whereas, you know, respect is, as you know, all parents know when they teach their kids, respect is earned, right? Mm. You know, you just don't get it because you ask for it. There wasn't a lot of that, certainly to show our international allies, right, of, you know, well, what do we have to look forward to under a Trump presidency? They can't be particularly reassured. And Nigel Farage of the Brexit campaign was interviewed right after the speech. And you know you're in trouble when even Nigel is not going to necessarily agree with where you're going.
There were two – in a speech that was almost devoid of explanation for how he was going to accomplish what he claimed to accomplish. There were two explanations. He had two policy explanations for one. He's going to build a wall, right? And he's been consistent about that. He's going to build this great impenetrable wall, you know, that spans from the Gulf of Mexico to the Sea of California, and there's that. The other is when it comes to trade, he's going to get every single country with which we trade to renegotiate the terms of that trade in a more positive direction for us. And I guess it's mind-boggling to me to reduce the complexity of trade itself, right? I mean, there's negative aspects about free trade. And Mr. Trump is, I think, right about some things with respect to the economic story of how the country's developed. There's real complexities there. So, I mean, trade is both good and bad, and there's advantages and disadvantages. And the trade deals themselves, extraordinarily complex, very complex, right? And this is necessary because the issues involved are numerous and complicated. And Mr. Trump is telling us that the complexities – are a result of stupid people negotiating them who are betraying America, right? Not because the issue itself is complex, but because incompetent people are
right.
behind
Just
it.
And giving away the store.
As soon right. as he steps in, somehow, right, all of these countries will say, oh, yes, they'll be cowed.
Of course you're right.
Right. So we'll make things much easier for American workers. I mean, it's a fantasy.
And then the last thing I would say with the speech is that we have this interesting juxtaposition between Third Night Ted Cruz and Trump's speech. So Cruz, like it or not, was talking about freedom and constitution, right? And these are the things we want to abide by, right? And these are the things right. we believe in. And Trump's speech
– law and order.
Law and order, lots of law and order. And I will would be the two watchwords there, right? I will do this. I will do that. Forgetting, of course, that we have this thing called a Congress or courts or whatnot right. that also have shared responsibilities with governing. It was suddenly, you know, if Trump wants it done, right, it will get done. And maybe that works as a CEO for governing, right. much more difficult.
Hmm. When he describes the United States as though it is a business that needs to be run like a business that that would seem to maybe be his mindset. And
well, his view of foreign policy in the interview this week was all about economics,
yes.
economic benefits, yes. costs, as if values and political perspectives and interests are irrelevant to foreign mm-hmm. policy.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the campaign is waged from this point on. And, of course, in the meantime, next week, the Democrats face some of the same challenges as the Republicans did as the Democrats convened their convention. And as I said, a week from today, President said it again, Professor Roberg, I don't know, I just feel like you should be president of something. Professor Roberg is going to be back a week from today to offer some analysis on all that ensues in that particular convention. And we won't make you predict. There isn't time for a prediction here anyway. But I do appreciate the expertise and thoughtfulness with which you've reflected on the last several days of this tumultuous Republican convention. Professor Jeff Roberg, Professor Jerry Mast, great to have both of you here on The Morning Show. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Larry Olmsted and his book, Real Food, Fake Food. On Tuesday, we'll speak with a young woman by the name of Laura Hermans, who's just back from a year-long mission trip in the country of Rwanda, a country dramatically transformed from its recent violent past. And on Wednesday, Professor Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program. On Thursday, Larry Tai, whose book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. In this fascinating book, Mr. Tai looks at how Robert F. Kennedy really was dramatically transformed from one sort of figure in the 1950s and early 60s into a very different political figure and force by the end of his life. And on Friday, a week from today, we will analyze the Democratic convention, which will have concluded by that point in time. The Morning Show is archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching.